Welcome to the Quest Podcast, proudly presented by the Muscular Dystrophy Association as part of the Quest family of content. I'm your host, Mindy Henderson. Together, we are here to bring thoughtful conversation to the neuromuscular disease community and beyond about issues affecting those with neuromuscular disease and other disabilities and those who love them. We are here for you to educate and inform, to demystify, to inspire, and to entertain. Thanks for joining. Now let's get started. My first guest is Dr. Paul Mehta. He is the principal investigator for the United States Congressionally Mandated National Amyotrophic Lateral Sclerosis, or ALS, registry, which resides within the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and is responsible for providing medical, scientific, and epidemiological expertise on matters related to ALS. Dr. Mehta, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Mindy, for having me, and thank you for bringing attention to ALS.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to speaking to you. And would you like to tell us just a little bit more about your background and the work that you do?
Sure. So I've been with the National ALS Registry for, it'll be 9 years this October as the PI. We're a small lit group of individual scientists at CDC-ATSDR. And what we do here is we try to figure out who gets ALS in the U.S., demographics of disease, epidemiology, the incidence, prevalence, and mortality of ALS. And more importantly, we also try to figure out what causes ALS, the risk factors for ALS. Why do patients get ALS? And hopefully, in the future, mitigate and potentially prevent ALS, which is very, very important.
Absolutely. Could you go ahead and give us an overview of exactly what ALS is and how it presents?
Sure. So ALS is part of the motor neuron disease family. Like you said earlier, it's ALS is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It is a progressive muscle weakness disease with the death of motor neurons, both in the upper and lower motor neurons. What ends up happening is patients present differently with ALS. Some can present with muscle weakness in the upper body or lower extremities. Some can also have difficulty walking, difficulty speaking, and so forth. Typically, no single ALS case is the same. It's always a bit different when it comes to presentation of the disease itself. Patients in general will have muscle weakness. They can have fatigue, also overactive reflexes as well. So it's just a kind of a different sort of amalgamation of sorts of symptoms they certainly can have and how they present to their the primary care physician and eventually when they go see a neurologist for a diagnosis.
Right. And so, I hear frequently in the work that I do that ALS is very hard to diagnose. I hear that oftentimes it can take several years even to get a diagnosis and to kind of follow those breadcrumbs to get to the correct diagnosis. Is it really the reasons that you just stated and how differently it presents that makes it so hard to diagnose?
Well, right now, there's no specific blood test for ALS or a specific test in terms of like there are for other diseases out there. You can't just take a blood test from your finger and say, hey, I've got ALS. So it's almost like where you're ruling out certain other diseases to figure out, hey, do you have ALS? Sometimes they call it a diagnosis of exclusion when it comes to ALS. And like I mentioned earlier, everyone kind of presents differently. Someone can present, for example, with a foot drop. Or some could present weakness in, let's say, their arm or their hand or something like that. So, and that can also be misdiagnosed because, for example, if you're an athlete or something like that, you've had a prior injury, which could be masking ALS, but potentially is ALS, but as a previous sports injury, it could be something else. So that's why it's kind of difficult to diagnose ALS because, like I said, everyone presents differently, and the signs and symptoms aren't always there in the beginning. They kind of progress. So you may have difficulties in, for example, speaking, it's kind of progressive. So, you're kind of fine, then it kind of gets worse and worse and worse. Then you go see your doctor to kind of figure out what's going on and so forth. So that by itself makes it a bit difficult to figure out, when ALS is occurring and when it's diagnosed. In general, it can take up to 12 months to go ahead and diagnose ALS. And there's a concerted effort by MDA and other groups to make sure we can kind of go ahead and make that diagnosing delay much shorter, as in terms of having it not as long as 12 months, making it hopefully less than 12 months, you know, 3 to 4 months, and letting providers out there, you know, be aware, hey, if there's a question, you know, go ahead and refer to a neurologist. If you have something, you know, you've not seen before or something, for example, if there's fasciculations in your tongue, which is presenting from the patient itself, to go ahead and, you know, refer to a neurologist or go ahead and make that referral just to be on the safe side. So we can potentially catch it early, but to go ahead and catch it early is very, very important.
Okay. So it sounds like there's a lot of discussion about trying to work toward earlier diagnosis of ALS for obvious reasons. The earlier you diagnose, the earlier you can treat. So it sounds though like there's nothing exactly that's really, for lack of a better term, like an ALS calling card, that if you see a particular thing, you should really think about looking into ALS.
Yes, that is correct. Other diseases, have calling cards out there. I mean, let me give you an example, like a heart attack. I mean, heart attack can present typically, in a very, very standard sort of a way. So you can have a referred pain in your arm. You could have sweating. You could have chest pain and so forth. It happens all acutely, let's say, in a heart attack. But with something like ALS, it's happening gradually. You know, I mentioned athletes. I mean, you have athletes out there who are very active, people who are very active, and hey, you know, my loved one tripped, my husband tripped, my spouse tripped, and so forth. You know what I'm saying? And that certainly can be very, very common, but that's when it's happening more and more often is where we want to, you know, kind of say, hey, let's go ahead and refer you to a specialist to kind of figure out to make sure it is not ALS or maybe it's something else happening as well. Every single patient presents differently. Every single patient progresses differently as well. Some patients progress slowly. Some patients progress very, very fast. So it just kind of depends on on the patient themselves and the actual disease characteristic too.
And so the fact that it does present so differently in everyone, is that part of or all of what makes it so challenging to attempt to research and better understand and treat the disease?
I would say yes. I think because it is not a set standard of symptoms which happen with ALS, they differ from patient to patient. So that makes it a bit more of a challenge for clinicians to say, hey, you know what, I think you may have ALS or you may not have ALS and so forth. For example, you could have someone who goes to the emergency room because they've tripped and they could be diagnosed. Well, hey, you know, you're potentially just tired. You know what I'm saying? And they may get sent home. And then a month or two later, they're back in the ER because they've tripped and they've had, let's say, now a head injury because resulting in their fall. It is a disease, which can occur in anybody, whether it's, males, females, and what we have seen, it generally occurs in males more so than females.
Okay. And you mentioned, athletes and firefighters, I think a minute ago. And this is something that I've recently learned is that, firefighters and athletes are actually at a higher risk for ALS than some other people. Can you explain sort of the relationship between those factors where you may have a very physical role in some sort, but then the relationship between that and the genetics that causes ALS?
So you mentioned firefighters. So firefighters are certainly exposed to chemicals throughout their occupation, and we're not sure if those chemicals potentially could cause or make them at greater risk for ALS. And that's one of the questions we want to answer. Mm-hmm. Athletes also, because they're doing a lot of stressful activities to their bodies and so forth, and that by itself can release, for example, oxidative stress. And so forth. And so we're not sure if that by itself could be a factor for ALS in certain athletes as well. There is some research that was done in Italy, which showed soccer players were greater risk at ALS. And that potentially could be because of hitting each other's heads when they're, you know, hitting a ball or so forth, and, you know, getting a concussion. But more research needs to be done in that area to kind of figure out if that certainly is the case or not. Another group which I want to mention is vets, military members.
Yes.
They are actually at twice the risk of getting ALS than those who've not served. And we're not sure why. And that's really important for us to kind of figure out why are our veterans at twice the risk of getting ALS than non-vets? And that's certainly a question we want to answer through research. You know, I mean, our vets are great patriots. They do a lot for the country and they give up a lot as well. And so it's certainly important for us to make sure, you know, hey, and find out the answers for them. You mentioned genetics. So about 90% of ALS is considered sporadic, meaning to say there's potentially a link to the environment and about 10% is considered familial ALS or FALS. And that's due to a certain number of genes that they may inherit. And those genes make them more likely to potentially get ALS than those who don't have the gene itself. There's certain genes that kind of come to mind. One is the SOD1 gene, as well as the C9orf72 gene, which are the two most common genes related to ALS. But like I said, about 90% of ALS is sporadic, potentially linked to the environment, and 10% is genetics.
Interesting. So what are the different therapies and treatments that are available for ALS right now, and how do they differ?
So right now, the two therapies out there is one's called Riluzole or Rilutek, and one's called Edaravone or Radicava. And these two therapies, what they do in general, they just prolong life for about 2 to 3 months on average. Some patients more than 2 to 3 months, some patients less. It all kind of depends on the patient themselves. Those are the only two drugs currently approved for ALS by the FDA. There are other drugs that are currently in clinical trials. Hopefully, they'll have a good trial outcome. One of them is AMX0035 or Amylyx. It's by the Amylyx company itself. And the FDA is going to be deciding exactly if that's going to be approved or not. But right now, Mindy, there's only two drugs out there for ALS. And I think that certainly is a frustration for patients because there's only two drugs out there. And on average, like I mentioned, these drugs are only prolonging life by 2 or 3 months. And we certainly need to have more drugs in the pipeline for potential clinical trials as well as for approvals. And there's a hunger for that. And that hunger needs to be met, you know, reverse the disease or prevent the disease itself. Those are certainly very, very important. So,
yeah. So the two drugs that exist today, are they drugs that would you choose one or the other, or can they be used in parallel?
They can be used in conjunction. It all depends on the neurologist and the provider, if they want to go ahead and take them in conjunction or not. And one of them is the IV infusion drug, which is Edaravone or Radicava. There's currently a clinical trial on Radicava, Edaravone, to see if an oral pill is going to work, which I think would be a very, very good thing. And then the other one is actually, it's also a pill or an oral suspension, Riluzole or Rilutek.
Great. So let's turn to the ALS registry and talk about that for just a second. Can you explain to me exactly what the ALS registry is and why someone should register, what the benefits are?
Absolutely. So the ALS registry was formed back in 2008 because ALS is devastating. It's a game changer. It's a life-changing event. There was a concerted push by patients and caregivers to have the registry. And once Congress passed the ALS Act itself, it tasked CDC to go ahead and establish the registry. We launched 2 years later on October 2010. And from there, we like to describe ourselves as a multifaceted research platform. So we do the number of cases of ALS in the U.S., the incidence, the prevalence, the mortality. Then, like I said, we also want to figure out what causes ALS, the risk factors behind ALS. And this is done by having patients come to the registry and take risk factor surveys about where do they live, where do they work, what were they potentially exposed to. We currently have 18 risk factor surveys in the registry that patients can take at their own leisure and in any order. And these risk factor surveys help researchers kind of figure out the unknowns of ALS. I like to say there are more unknowns than knowns about ALS at this point. And what we're doing at CDC ATSDR is to figure out those knowns. And we do that by funding research through academia, as well as having patients take our risk factor surveys, as well as being counted. It's very, very important to be counted and having joined the ALS registry and coming to cdc.gov/ALS and signing up. And from there, we can give you information about a biorepository, which is a National ALS Biorepository, where we go to patients' homes to go and collect their blood completely for free. And that blood is used to look for areas such as genetics, biomarkers, and so forth, disease progression. We also work with big drug companies out there as well. I'm sure if you heard of Amylyx I mentioned earlier. We've helped to work with Brainstorm, Cytokinetics, Biogen, as well as Mitsubishi Tanabe Pharma in their clinical trials. So they come to us for recruitment assistance, and we send their information to our pool of ALS patients. And those patients will in turn will go ahead and contact the drug company about the clinical trial itself. And so this is called a research notification mechanism, where we'll go ahead and we're kind of like a matchmaker. They come to us, we give them information about the clinical trial. They'll go ahead and contact the drug company to see if they're eligible about this clinical trial. So it's a great resource. And I also mentioned research. So we currently have funded 21 research institutions out there of higher learning to figure out what causes ALS and those risk factors. So for example, whether it's pesticides, insecticides, metals, if that's a risk factor, genetics. So we're also funding different groups out there internationally as one. One group we funded was Trinity College out in Dublin, and they were looking to see why the ALS population in South America gets ALS at a much lower rate than, let's say, the Caucasian population in Europe. And that's certainly interesting to say, hey, how come this particular demographic group is getting ALS at a much lower rate than those, let's say, in Europe? And so from that, we can certainly learn and see why that is the case.
Very interesting. So it sounds like it's really fairly patient-driven to go and register, or are there also doctors who input information into the registry as well?
No, we don't at this point have doctors inputting information. I believe the MOVA registry is, you know, the MOVA system is that way for MDA, but we currently don't have it that way. It's all patient-driven. Patients can come in, sign up with the help of their caregivers, or even with the help of, let's say, an MDA, a clinic personnel as well. They can help them sign up too, and so forth. So it is all patient-driven where they come to our registry to go ahead and sign up. The registry also gets their cases from CMS, Centers for Medicare Services, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as well as the VA system. We have agreements with them to go ahead and get their cases into the registry as well.
That's fantastic. Well, it certainly sounds like the registry is well positioned to provide hope to ALS patients just in the work that you're doing and the answers that you're trying to uncover. You know, as we kind of wrap things up, what do you think is, you know, with the trends that you're seeing in the research and the things that you're learning, what do you think is the most exciting thing happening in ALS research today that might provide potentially patients or families who are listening with some of that hope?
Absolutely. So, I mean, first of all, I want to say our registry is for patients. It's their registry, and we are caretakers of that registry. You know, there's been so much attention to ALS, but I always say there's always going to be more attention paid to ALS. ALS is a rare disease, but it's not a rare disease if you get ALS. So it's a life-changing event. And therefore, I think, you know, it's very important to make sure ALS gets the attention it needs and deserves out there, especially for research, especially for, you know, realizing, hey, these are people out there who've got this disease, life-changing event. And frankly, you know, Mindy, the ALS patients I've met throughout, you know, throughout my, you know, my time as the principal investigator, they are some of the nicest individuals out there. They're very altruistic individuals, very, very humble people, and they really touch your heart. And for me, I think just seeing what's happening these days in the ALS community with the research out there, with the potential therapeutics, you know, coming online, you know, fingers crossed, that these will be approved, and these will also be, you know, new ones will be coming up online as well. It's really, really important. You know, I think it's, you know, for me as a, you know, as a clinician and a researcher, it's very important to, you know, to share that hope and to share that that optimism with the ALS patients and the community, because we want something, you know, to help these patients to either, like I said, either to slow, halt, reverse, or prevent their disease. I think it's very important. And there certainly is a lot of excitement out there, whether it's at CDC or whether it's at other clinics out there. For example, Massachusetts General Hospital is a huge clinic out there as well. Johns Hopkins also has a very, very big center out there as well. These are all groups that want the exact same thing. We want to make sure we have therapeutics out there that can help these patients, you know, make ALS a livable disease, you know, make it where these patients, you know, can enjoy time with their family. And pretty much, you know, and hopefully, you know, lead a life where they can, like I said, enjoy time with their family and just be with their loved ones.
That's great. Let's, if you don't mind, give that URL one more time so that people
absolutely
can register.
It's cdc.gov/ALS.
Perfect. And I'm going to put that in the show notes as well, just in case anyone listening doesn't have a pen handy. Dr. Mehta, thank you so much for your time and for all of the incredible work that you all are doing and for sharing your knowledge with us today.
Thank you, Mindy. And thank you for having us. I appreciate it.
My next guest is Dr. Elizabeth Kilroy, Watching the progression of her father's and brother's muscular dystrophy ignited Dr. Kilroy's passion for understanding the intricacy of the neuromuscular system and human movement. Dr. Kilroy has a ton of super impressive credentials, and I love speaking to people that are so much smarter than me. I'm going to go ahead and just let you, Dr. Kilroy, if you don't mind introducing yourself and telling us a little about your background.
Yeah, I'm Elizabeth Kilroy. You can call me Dr. Kilroy if you want, but it still feels so surreal and just kind of out of place for me. But I currently serve as the director of MOVER, which is MDA's patient registry. And so my journey to becoming the director of MOVER really starts, as you mentioned, my dad and brother have an unknown type of muscular dystrophy. Taking a step back, it became a family tradition to watch the Jerry Lewis telethon on TV every year.
Yeah.
And I just have such a vivid memory of me sitting on the living room floor in my like Power Ranger onesie, telling my brother that when I grew up, I was going to answer telephones during the telethon.
And oh my gosh.
It's kind of surreal to actually be working at the MDA, but not actually be answering the telephone. So,
oh, that's so cool. I love that story.
Yeah, so fast forward a few years, and I was sitting in the hospital trying to understand why doctors were telling me that my father would never walk again because he had a spinal cord injury. And as you said in the intro, it kind of ignited my curiosity for understanding human movement. And then fast forward a few more years, and my brother received the diagnosis of muscular dystrophy. And I really found myself trying to understand why doctors were telling him that they do not know what type of muscular dystrophy is, nor what gene is causing it. You know, you heard on the news, like the buzzwords of human genome sequencing, and we can identify all your genes. And I didn't understand why they didn't know why his muscles were wasting. And at that time, I was also recovering from my third knee surgery. And I was really frustrated because I wasn't gaining back the strength that I wanted to or the muscle mass that I lost from being on bed rest with my knee. So from there, I chose to study exercise science and neuroscience in college and really fell in love with like the basic science researcher and like being in the lab and really trying to understand the intricacies of human movement, how muscle responds to injury, and how muscle responds to stimuli like strength training or inactivity. And then after college, I wanted to pursue a PhD. My dad has his PhD, and I always wanted to become Dr. Kilroy too. So now we can kind of duel it out and see who's the better Dr. Kilroy. But then once I completed my PhD, I went on to do training in a gene therapy lab, so really trying to push out cures for these diseases. But I really learned that being at the lab bench wasn't where I could have the biggest impact. I really wanted to interact with individuals with neuromuscular diseases, interact with clinicians, researchers, drug developers, policymakers. And so that really led me to becoming the director of MOVER, where I could interact with all these individuals and have as big of an impact as possible.
That's amazing. And I have to say, I suspect your brother and your father are probably incredibly proud of you. And, you know, these are such hard things to go through in life. But when you're kind of, as cheesy as it sounds, when your pain becomes your purpose, you know, it's such a special thing. And I love working for MDA myself, and hearing about the work that you all are doing on MOVER is amazing. So I want to jump right in. Let's start with MOVER. Do you want to just start out by explaining to everyone what is MOVER and when was it created?
Yeah, of course. So MOVER stands for the Neuromuscular Observational Research Data Hub, and it was launched in 2019 after seeing how successful MDA's pilot registry was. It's the United States Neuromuscular Disease Registry, or USNDR, and it was really started to see if MDA could fill the gaps in the data shortage for neuromuscular diseases. And also just the availability of this data. So the USNDR collected longitudinal data from 26 MDA care centers And there was about 2,700 participants diagnosed with one of four diseases. So it was ALS, BMD, DMD, and SMA. And it really represented the first centralized registry to house data on multiple neuromuscular diseases with a standardized framework for collecting that data, meaning data is collected using like an electronic form, and it's standard for all the diseases. So the data is coming in and it's very easy to use, very easy to analyze. So Mover now represents a more rigorous or expandable platform with seven different diseases that are captured. So now we're capturing, in addition to ALS, BMD, DMD, and SMA, we're now capturing also FSHD, LGMD, and Pompe disease. So it's still powered by the nationwide network of care centers, and it's available to every care center. So care centers can elect to activate the Mover study protocol and become a Mover site. So now they can start, when they see patients in the clinic, they can ask them if they would like to participate in Mover. Every time they come back to the clinic, the data that is collected at that visit is then entered into Mover. So there is an onboarding process for the care centers, but our long-term goal is to hopefully make sure every care center becomes an active Mover site.
That's fantastic. And I think at last count, we had something like 163 care centers. That's a lot of...
And we have, right now we have 60 Mover sites. So
fantastic.
We're almost there.
We're getting close. Okay. Yeah. So what are the plans to expand to other conditions? I would imagine that it's pretty methodical and the criteria is probably pretty specific each time you add a new condition to the Mover database. But what does that look like, the consideration to add a new disease? And like I said, what are the plans to expand?
Yeah, this is really a great question. And we hear this a lot from, you know, industries who are interested in accessing Mover data, clinicians that are, you know, seeing patients in the clinic, and other researchers really interested and invested in these neuromuscular diseases. So we want to expand Mover to include all neuromuscular diseases. And right now we're working on adding CMT, myasthenia gravis, and myotonic dystrophy. But one of the biggest hurdles in adding more indications is what we refer to as a data entry burden. So Mover's capturing clinic entered data. So when the individual is seen at a participating Mover site, all of their data is being entered into the electronic medical record or health record, but then that data needs to then be transferred into Mover. And this transfer is done manually by research coordinators and trained study staff at that site. So it takes time to complete the data entry process. So we have a standardized set of questions. They have to look at the medical record and then use that to answer these questions. So we're really trying to alleviate this manual data entry by using other data entry methods such as batch uploading or integrating the electronic health record with Mover, and even trying some new things like artificial intelligence and machine learning to be able to pull data directly from the medical record and put it directly into Mover.
Okay, so you mentioned a standard set of questions. Is the set of questions that you ask patients, I guess, is it the same data that you capture from disease to disease, or is there some variance?
There is some variant. So for all indications, we capture data using four different forms. So we have a demographics form, a diagnostic form, an encounter form, and a discontinuation form. So the demographics form and the discontinuation form are the same. So the demographics form is going to capture the participant's date of enrollment into Mover, date of birth, gender, race, ethnicity, insurance type, education, and employment. And then the discontinuation form is going to capture the reason for discontinuation, such as, was the patient lost to follow-up? Did they move to another clinical site? Is the patient withdrawing from the study, or has the participant become deceased? And if so, what was the date and cause of the death. But then the diagnosis form and the encounter form are unique to each individual indication. Each disease has their own kind of diagnostic criteria and diagnosis method. And then the encounter form is what's completed at every visit. And every disease has different functional measures, disease progression measures and markers, and that we want to make sure that that's captured for each disease on its own. So there's different criteria and questions in those forms.
That makes sense. So when you mentioned earlier that at the care center, the practitioner will ask a patient if they want to participate in MOVER. If they say yes, are there specific touch points?
So we do ask that care centers enter data from their normal visits at the care center. And we don't make care centers, since it is an observational study, we don't make care centers do anything that they wouldn't normally be doing in the visit. And if something is not done at that visit or within, you know, 30 days leading up to that visit, we just don't capture it. So for example, for a lot of these neuromuscular diseases, there's a lot of functional tests like the 6-minute walk test or time to climb 4 stairs, time to rise from supine. And if this isn't being done at that visit, we don't ask the care center director or the physician to do these tests. We just want to capture it if it was already done. Because again, we don't want to burden the sites with more things to do. We just want to capture everything that's already being done.
I see. And I do want to shift gears in just a second and talk about ALS in particular. But just in general, can you tell me a little bit about what we've been able to do with the MOVER data so far?
Yeah, I absolutely love this question. It kind of gets me like so pride and joy. It's something that I'm really excited about because it takes time to get data into a database, as you can imagine. But now that we have data from over 4,000 participants, I think the last time I checked, we're at 4,400. So it's a lot of data.
That's
now.
That's fantastic.
So, yeah, it really is. So two of the biggest things that we've been able to achieve or accomplish with MOVER data thus far is to run clinical trial feasibility analyses and perform clinical trial matching. So for clinical trial feasibility, companies will send us their inclusion and exclusion criteria for their proposed trial, and we can then determine how many MOVER participants would be eligible to participate, but also determine which criteria are causing the number of eligible participants to be decreased. And this information can then be used by the company to kind of reevaluate whether or not that specific criterion is really necessary. For example, boys with DMD and steroid use. So a lot of clinical trials are, you know, very specific about their steroid regimen, how long they've been on it, and this could impact whether or not a participant is eligible. So are those steroid criteria necessary? And so then the company can kind of reevaluate how they want to proceed in order to recruit the most number of participants as possible. Companies can send us their inclusion and exclusion criteria, and then we perform analyses to actually identify eligible participants. And then we send the information about the trial to the principal investigators at the MOVER site, along with the ID numbers of those participants who do qualify or could be potentially eligible. And then the clinician at the site can confirm a participant's eligibility, decide whether the trial would be a good fit, and then share that information with the participant, and the participant can decide to reach out to the company running the trial.
I love it. And that's so exciting because, like, I'm thinking back to my own journey with SMA and, you know, growing up before things like Spinraza and other treatments were available, there were clinical trials that I knew were out there happening and going on, but I never really knew how to get plugged into them. The idea that now you've got this database where you can proactively identify trial participants and things and make these trials available to them, that's really exciting.
Yeah. And that, just like you said, like there's so many trials out there, but a lot of families and, you know, patients, they don't always know what allows them to be included or excluded. Right. And also clinicians are so busy and they see so many patients. It's hard for them to learn about a trial and then be able to immediately go and say, okay, I know this participant, and this participant would qualify and be a good candidate. Now we're doing that heavy lifting for them. And then they ultimately just get to go back and view the data and make sure that, yes, they would be a good fit.
That's amazing. So I spoke with Dr. Mehta from the ALS registry also for this podcast. And it sounds like kind of the, I'm sure there are other differences, but the difference that's really sort of in my mind become one of the primary differences between the ALS registry and MOVER is that the ALS registry is largely patient driven. So patients register on their own and share their information. MOVER is sort of initiated by a physician. And while a patient has to consent to participate, it's incumbent on the doctor to approach a patient about it. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So once the patient consents to participate in MOVER, that's it. The rest is on the clinician and the study staff. Mm-hmm. So again, the biggest thing that separates MOVER from other registries, data captured in MOVER is clinic entered, and it's transferred directly from the medical record. Mm-hmm. So this not only ensures like continuity among the data from different sites, different participants, but it sets MOVER up to become a very rich source of data that could be used for regulatory submission. So the data can be used to show the FDA that a drug or therapy is safe and effective, or, you know, if participants in MOVER are serving as kind of like a natural history or comparator arm for a trial, they have all this good patient or clinic entered data rather than a patient trying to answer questions that they might not fully understand or know as expected.
Gotcha. So I mentioned ALS a little while ago. May is ALS Awareness Month. So I'd love to zero in a little bit on the data that's collected in MOVER for ALS. Can you tell us about the kinds of data that you collect around ALS?
Yeah, so ALS is actually one of my favorite data sets to explore and analyze because there's over 2,000 participants that have been collecting data in MOVER. So I had mentioned earlier about the different case report forms. So for ALS, the diagnosis form captures data around the date of symptom onset and the date of diagnosis. As we know, symptom onset to diagnosis can be relatively long. And so we're trying to understand what is the fastest way to make that timeline shorter. We also collect which body regions were first affected, upper extremity, lower extremity, was it the bulbar? And then we collect whether genetic testing was done and what the results were. So the genetic testing, you know, there are some candidate genes out there known to lead to ALS, but then there's also some sporadic cases too. So we want to understand that. And then one of the main diagnostic tests right now is the revised Ellis scorial criterion. So we capture that. And then also family history. So trying to understand if anyone in your family also is battling ALS or has battled ALS.
Well, and it's such a complicated disease. And it's so, from what I understand, not being a doctor, but it's hugely variable from patient to patient, which must make it really, really challenging.
And that's what's really cool about having so many participants. I mean, 2,000 is a huge number. And so I kind of mentioned the diagnostic form, but really the bread and butter of MOVER is the encounter form, because this is capturing the longitudinal data. So at every clinical visit. And so this is collecting information about clinical trial participation, falls, and hospitalizations. One of the functional tests for ALS is the ALS-FRS scores. So that asks you about climbing stairs, walking, swallowing, using your hands. It also looks at nutritional therapy use, mental and cognitive status, medications, disease progression, assistive devices, pulmonary and cardiology, functional measures, and then also who the patient was seen by at that visit and referred to. And I think the referral data is what's really interesting to me because, you know, what are the most common practices that participants are being referred to and why could that be?
Interesting. How is ALS mover data feeding into clinical research or trials?
Yeah, so we actually get to partner with researchers to combine data. So combining data from mover with other data sets, as well as starting to collect new types of data. So we're currently working with a company to set up a study that would be run side by side with mover. And this is really trying to track what is living with ALS like day to day versus just at that clinical visit. So I think we can definitely back clinical trials by, for example, recruiting participants to participate in a company trial and still be involved in mover and kind of combining those data sets.
That's great. What do you think is the most exciting thing happening in ALS research today?
It's just always been a fascinating disease because it's so different. Every individual is affected so different. Every new paper comes out and it's just a whole different view of what ALS is. And it's just kind of one of those diseases where you just keep learning about and you keep making progress and understanding, but then something new comes up and it's, as a scientist, it kind of blows my mind.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating, you know, like we just, everyone you know, you at least know one person in your life that has battled ALS and it can just be really hard. But one thing that I really am loving is all the different tools that we're developing and we're using to understand the disease. So for me, that is like, when I looked up this question last night, like what's new in ALS to kind of, you know, prep myself.
And yeah.
I was just amazed by all the different animal models. So they're using Drosophila, so fruit fly, C. elegans, so worms,
oh my
zebrafish.
Gosh.
So I'm biased because zebrafish was what my PhD used. And mice. And there's so many different models in using the different knocking out the different genes to understand what happens when you no longer have that gene, using different techniques. So for example, with flies and worms, it's very easy to manipulate their genes and add environmental stressors. So you can kind of understand like what happens when they don't have this gene, what happens to the nervous system, what happens to the muscle. And then with zebrafish, they're completely transparent from fertilization up to 15 days. And now I'm nerding out, but so being completely transparent, you can literally visualize the nerves growing and the muscles being innervated by these nerves. So
wow.
It's really great to see all these papers utilizing all the old techniques, new techniques, and developing even more techniques with the technology that we have and the science we have. So I think that's something that is really most fascinating to me in the ALS world.
Yeah, interesting. And again, not a scientist, but what is coming to mind for me in listening to you explain this and the different kinds of animals and organisms that they're looking at, I would think that that would be incredibly helpful in sort of getting to all of the different ways that ALS can present.
I think that when we look at science, we have to look through multiple lenses. And
yeah.
This is really allowing us to look at multiple lenses mm-hmm. and multiple sizes, you know, going yeah. from a little tiny fly all the way up to a little mouse. I mean,
yeah.
Their systems are different, but they're the same. So it's really cool to understand a disease in multiple different contexts.
That's really interesting. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to wrap this up, but are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners about ALS research or mover in general?
Yeah, so I just want to say, you know, my family's motto is adapt and overcome. So every day is a new day that brings kind of new challenges. So I just ask listeners to keep fighting. Fighting against ALS and all the other neuromuscular diseases. And as a researcher, like, I know we are on the brink of bringing a lot of effective and life-altering therapies to you and to individuals with these diseases. And kind of one thing that I've learned is that strength is in numbers. So the more participants in MOVER, the more data we have to generate hypotheses, to make conclusions, and the more individuals we kind of have raising awareness about these rare diseases, the more power we have to kind of influence policies and support therapeutic development. So with Congress passing the Act for ALS, I mean, that's huge, not only for ALS, but all neuromuscular diseases. So I ask everyone to keep adapting, overcoming, and keep fighting the fight against ALS.
So well said. Thank you so much for your time and for being here today. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much, Mindy.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the guests you heard from today, go check them out at mda.org/podcast. And to learn more about the Muscular Dystrophy Association, the services we provide, how you can get involved, and to subscribe to Quest Magazine or to Quest Newsletter, please go to mda.org/quest. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd be grateful if you'd leave a review. Go ahead and hit that subscribe button so we can keep bringing you great content, and maybe share it with a friend or two. Thanks, everyone. Until next time, go be the light we all need in this world.